This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington.
My name is Barbara. I've been listening and watching the impeachment hearings, and I have never been so disheartened in my life. I'm just so saddened, distraught, frustrated with how our country is being governed. Never in my 73 years have I been so upset.
My name is Stephanie. I'm calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. As far as conversations here in Oklahoma, most of the people who are willing to open up or talk to me, they're either attorneys or they work in law enforcement, et cetera, and they can see very clearly that he's broken the law and violated the Constitution.
This is Bob from Dover, Ohio. The inquiry, as well as the articles of impeachment, I think it's awful to drag the country through this. I have always been a registered D, and I don't really believe the evidence is there. And I just think it's quite frankly a sham.
My name is Eliza. I don't think that the impeachment is necessarily going to change anything at all. The way it will be spun by the very adequate people on the right is that this is a miscarriage of justice. And the way that it will be spun by the very adequate people on the left is that to not pursue this is a miscarriage of justice.
So can you relate? Maybe to how distraught Barbara is, to the conversation Stephanie is hearing, to Bob's skepticism, to Eliza's expectation of a lot of political spin. Congress is preparing to formally vote on two articles of impeachment against President Trump. Soon we'll find out what they really think of these accusations. Right now, let's talk through what you think and what you want to know. Joining us from KRVS in Lafayette, Louisiana, is Angie Holan, the editor of PolitiFact. Angie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us from Houston is Josh Blackman, associate professor of law at the South Texas College of Law. Professor Blackman, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And here with us in studio is Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a progressive think tank based here in Washington. Elizabeth, glad to have you back.
Great to be here.
We're glad to get in your questions and thoughts about impeachment, the process, the politics, what you think will happen, how you've been discussing this, where you are. Basically, the point of today is to give you a chance to feedback. We know that the last month has felt kind of like a data dump, with hearing after hearing after hearing after hearing, nonstop coverage, continuing coverage and analysis and sound bites and talking points and so on. And we just haven't had a chance to hear from you. That's what today is all about. So please do chime in and sound off. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Angie, let me start with you with just some basic information. So yesterday morning, House Democrats announced the articles of impeachment against President Trump. What were they and what do they actually mean?
Well, there were two articles. The first one is labeled abuse of power, and that one outlines President Trump's actions in regards to Ukraine, asking for investigations into Joe Biden and investigations into what's called the CrowdStrike theory that Ukraine potentially meddled in the 2016 election. I should add that that theory is pretty discredited. The first article then says Trump asked for this and he withheld aid, and the purpose, the article says, is that he wanted to affect the 2020 election. So that's the first article. The second article is about his what they say is his obstruction of Congress. So this is President Trump's direction to the executive agency not to cooperate with impeachment. So the White House directed people not to testify, and they said documents should not be released. And this second article outlines this and says Congress has the power of impeachment. It should not have been impeded in its impeachment inquiries. And so that's the second article.
Now, obstruction of Congress. Elaborate on that a little bit. Obstruction of justice is a phrase we heard a lot during the Mueller investigation for a variety of reasons. Is that kind of in the same ballpark as obstruction of Congress, or is that something else?
It's somewhat in the same ballpark, but this particular article goes to the fact that Congress conducted the inquiry into this Ukraine matter. So it wasn't a Department of Justice lawyer. It wasn't a special counsel. It was Congress itself, the House Intelligence Committee, that investigated the matter. So the obstruction was against Congress itself. And that seems to be the primary reason it's obstruction of Congress, not obstruction of justice. I'd be interested in hearing from your legal guests on this point as well. But from our reading of all the materials, that's the reason for it.
For sure. And we're going to work our way into the conversation with Elizabeth and Professor Blackmun in just one second. With regards to these two articles, Angie, do we know why House Democrats chose them? I mean, for a long time, we heard the phrase quid pro quo, which speaks to bribery, which is specified by name in the Constitution as one of two specific crimes that can get someone impeached, the other one being treason. Why not go after bribery specifically?
It's pretty interesting that they settled on only two articles because there was a lot of discussion among Democrats in the House and among the pundits commenting on this that they could come up with more articles of impeachment. So bribery that you mentioned, or there's the emoluments clause. That's I won't get into too much detail there, but it's about accepting benefits from foreign governments. There is the Mueller report. There were potential charges of obstruction of justice that Democrats discussed from that. At the end of the day, they decided on just these two, and it seems to be they did it to keep things simple and to stay unified.
I want to get into some perspectives on whether or not the case is strong enough for the president's impeachment. But first, Elizabeth, just by way of setting the groundwork for this, and Professor, feel free to disagree in just a minute, but I think just to boil it all the way down, Elizabeth, the central question seems to be, at least the way that Democrats have articulated it, do the actions of President Trump and the Trump administration disqualify him from running for re-election? That seems to be what this is about, particularly the comments that Adam Schiff made yesterday about, you know, should we let him cheat one more time? At least on the Democratic side, Elizabeth, I think that's the overarching question, is one of disqualification.
Well, so I think I would slightly tweak that and bring it back to the founders who put impeachment as a remedy in the Constitution in the first place. Now, one of the things that they talked about in putting impeachment as a remedy in, and, you know, some people say, oh, you should let the people decide, et cetera. Well, the founders obviously knew that there were elections for president of the United States and still put impeachment in the Constitution as a remedy. And part of the reason they did that specifically, you can look back to comments from William Davey, for example, at the Constitutional Convention. And they worried that a president who was corrupt in office might use the vast powers of his office as president in order to corruptly get himself reelected. That was a specific concern of the founders. And so I think that that overarches the entire impeachment inquiry in this particular case, where, you know, as opposed to the impeachment context of Clinton or Nixon, you have the specific situation of a president using the leverage of his office and the interests of the American people to get a benefit that could help him get reelected. And so that is why I think the idea of the ballot box, which is a routine measure of checking our elected leaders, is not sufficient in this case. It's also just a matter of standing up for the Constitution. As one of the professors who testified said, if this is not an impeachable offense, if these are not impeachable offenses, what are?
With regards to standing for the Constitution, one of our listeners tweeted, it's my opinion that the president forced the Dems' hand, the Democrats' hand. If we stand on the Constitution and stand for it, they had no choice. Will anything come of it? No, but history will be on the side of democracy and the Democrats. Professor Blackmun, another issue that's come up in terms of this whole process is the standard of impeachment and the difference between, let's say, a court of law versus this kind of constitutional congressional trial. And they're not quite the same standard. I think that's been one of the big arguments that's hovered over all of this.
That's right. In courts of law, people can only be charged with specific statutory offenses, that is, crimes that are defined by the legislature. But the Constitution doesn't limit impeachment to crimes that are spelled out. This phrase used is high crimes or misdemeanors. And that can include some offenses that have not been ever prosecuted before. And what makes this entire process very different from a court proceeding is the offenses are drawn up by the Congress seeking to remove the president. It's this, you know, the same person is basically the judge, jury, and the executioner. They get to decide what the offense is, and then they get to decide whether impeachment is appropriate.
I know that you and Elizabeth have differing views on whether the president can be impeached based on the evidence thus far. Professor Blackmun, what do you think?
I think a few things can be said. The first thing is that these two articles of impeachment are unique. I think it's the first time in American history where you have an article of impeachment that's not grounded in some specific violation of law. I don't think that's disqualifying. I think the impeachment article may still be proper. But I think that at that point, the House has a bigger burden to show that the crime they defined, abuse of power, is in fact a high crime or misdemeanor in this case. I think they're by not picking obstruction of justice, by not picking bribery, their challenge is a little bit more difficult to prove that this article of legitimate, I'm sorry, this article of impeachment is proper.
Elizabeth, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as Josh himself would acknowledge, you don't have to have violated a specific statute in order to be impeached. And, you know, I think if you look at the degree of the abuse of office that we're talking about, it squarely fits within the reason for impeachment being a remedy in the first place. The idea that an elected leader would abuse their office, would do something that was so detrimental to the fundamentals of American democracy, that this serious and sober remedy of removing a duly elected official was appropriate.
We'll continue in just a moment with Elizabeth Wydra of the Constitutional Accountability Center, Josh Blackman, Associate Professor of Law at South Texas College of Law, and Angie Holan, Editor of PolitiFact. We want to hear from you, too. Your questions, thoughts about impeachment, 1A at WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are spending this hour listening to you and getting your thoughts on the articles of impeachment announced by House Democrats yesterday with Angie Holan, editor of PolitiFact, Josh Blackman, an associate professor of law at South Texas College of Law, and Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Pete tweeted, "The heart of the impeachment charges is clear, Trump putting personal gain above our country's interests. But so much media coverage, including on NPR, loses this with endless babble about events rather than clear insights that could help more Americans understand. It's disheartening." Well, Pete, hopefully this hour will not dishearten you further, because that's kind of the whole point of this conversation. So if you could use more clear insights on this impeachment thing, or if you just want to be heard, because we really haven't heard from the American people that much about this. We haven't heard from you very much. Now's a good time to speak up. Please leave the babble out, of course, and certainly don't make an endless. But do comment on our Facebook page. Tweet us at 1A, which is impossible to babble endlessly. I think you've only got 280 characters. Or email us, 1A at WAMU.org. One of our listeners thought that the Democrats are just being too narrow with the two articles of impeachment that we mentioned earlier. Here's what they left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Tama, and I think that the Democrats are being too narrow in their scope on these impeachment clauses. I think a lot of Americans don't really care what happens in foreign countries like Ukraine. And I also think that they should bring in the emoluments clause, where the president is making millions of dollars off of our tax dollars.
Tama, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Angie, we've already kind of talked about the emoluments clause. I wonder what you think about that other part in terms of Americans not really caring what happens in foreign countries like Ukraine. That's pretty much the basis of the genesis of these impeachment complaints. How do you see that, Angie?
Well, in our coverage of elections, I think it's pretty obvious that Americans care more about domestic policy than foreign policy. When you ask voters what are your most important issues for any given election, they usually say the economy or healthcare. Sometimes they say education or the environment, but those are primarily domestic concerns. Foreign policy, I think, is a heavier lift for a lot of Americans when they're thinking about their elected officials. Now, of course, you can't say it's not important. It's really important, and it's always discussed a lot every election cycle. But I think we'd be naive to say that most Americans are really super interested in what's going on in foreign countries and the U.S. positions there. And a lot of the discussion in this impeachment inquiry was about the United States, its relationship with Russia, Russia's aggression toward Ukraine and Ukraine's position as this kind of a pivotal country that had a history with Russia but is now trying to move more toward Western Europe. And honestly, I think some Americans are bored by those issues.
Elizabeth, what about that assertion Tama made that the Democrats might be too narrow in their scope on these impeachment clauses?
Yeah, I mean, first, you know, I think this isn't actually about foreign policy. It's about American democracy. And the point is that whether you're talking about the emoluments clause or the president leveraging his office on the global stage with respect to Ukraine, the idea is that he should always be acting with unclouded loyalty to the American people who put him in office. And with whether it's the emoluments clause or the Ukraine, what we're seeing and what the evidence shows is that he has acted with respect to his personal, his President Trump's interest in his bottom line with respect to his finances or his political bottom line, trying to get himself reelected by bullying and bribing a foreign official. So I think that's the main thing. You know, are there uncountable offenses to the Constitution that President Trump has committed since he's gotten into office? I would say yes, as a constitutional lawyer. It's, you know, but it's a judgment that the Democrats have made in the House about what is going to be most salient. And I think where you have here unequivocal evidence that the president did these actions with respect to Ukraine. You might think they're impeachable or not, but the facts are there. And it's unquestionable that he refused to let his officials testify. He obstructed the impeachment inquiry. I think because those are so clear and so simple, that's probably why they went with them.
Although it's interesting, Elizabeth, a lot of the things that Democrats have complained about with regard to President Trump have had to do with his dealings around the world, whether it's the way he's treated NATO,
right,
whether it's the crisis at the southern border, the rewriting of NAFTA, his dealings with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, his dealings with China, his dealings with Russia, you know, cozying up to strongmen around the world. Like, it seems like the Democrats' complaints about President Trump are all these foreign policy things that Americans don't pay as much attention to.
Right. And, you know, I think that has helped him in a lot of ways get away with a lot of things, you know, but I think that's probably because it's frankly easier for him in some ways to deal with. You know, we've seen he seems to really enjoy his interactions with more authoritarian regimes around the globe. And that has been lucrative, certainly for his own personal businesses. And as we've seen, he's seen that as an opportunity to try to impact his political chances here in the United States. You know, the idea is that you depend on the American people. So if you want to get reelected, don't try to bully Ukraine into doing something to help you in the next election. Try to have policies that help all of the Americans who might come out and vote for you.
Professor, I want to get your thoughts in terms of the narrowness of this, partly because yesterday President Trump had a rally in Hershey, Pennsylvania, not far from Harrisburg, the state capital, where he responded to the House's announcement of the articles of impeachment. Here is part of what the president said.
Today, the House Democrats announced these two flimsy, pathetic, ridiculous articles of impeachment. The House Democrats are walking back from everything they claimed with today's announcement. There was no obstruction of justice, and there were no crimes whatsoever. There are no crimes. It says it. There are no crimes. They're impeaching me, and there are no crimes.
That was President Trump speaking at a rally in Hershey, Pennsylvania yesterday. Professor Blackman, I'd love to get your reaction to this for two reasons. One, I believe that ignoring congressional subpoenas is actually against the law, so I don't think that's true. And two, I'm not sure if it matters how many crimes there are. I mean, I could be a Boy Scout for my entire life, but if I beat one person to death with my bare hands, all of a sudden, all the nice things I did disappear. I don't know that the amount of counts actually matters as much as it matters what the counts are for. But how do you see it?
Well, there are two articles. Let's take them in order. The first article is abuse of power. And the allegation here is that the president requests this investigation with a corrupt motive, that is to harm his political adversary, Joe Biden. If Trump had requested an investigation of John Doe, a random person, we wouldn't be here. So it wasn't that the act was inappropriate, right? Presidents can request investigations. The problem is that he did so with an intent to weaken his political opponent. The second issue is a bit less clear. Congress has issued many subpoenas to presidents going back decades and decades and decades. And often presidents have said, no, I will not respond to that subpoena. And then they have to go to court to litigate what's known as privilege. What's somewhat unique about this case is that the president has issued a categorical policy. I will not reply to any subpoenas. I will assert absolute privilege. And that was a letter from the White House counsel. So we really don't have much precedent. I think one federal court ruled that the president's theory was wrong, but it was only a single district court judge. Whether this is impeachable, I think the Senate will have to make a call on. But we don't have this sort of article that's been fully vetted in the past because we haven't had presidents who have taken this sort of categorical position.
Let's get into some of your comments now. We'll talk about the Senate in just a bit, but glad to hear from those of you who've got thoughts about the impeachment. Sandra tweeted, I'm an independent in Justin Amash's district in Michigan. Justin Amash is a member of Congress. His district includes Grand Rapids and the areas kind of just east of Kalamazoo. I was a reluctant impeacher, but I read the Mueller report and watched the impeachment hearings, and I became convinced that President Trump needed to be held accountable for his actions. Bravo to the brave men and women who testified. Mike tweeted, I'm astonished the GOP can ignore Trump's bad behavior and offer no apology, but I'm equally amazed how the Democrats burrow through the political quagmire without concern for House rules or the lack of physical evidence. Angie Holland, could you respond to that? Let's take that in two parts. First, the GOP ignoring Trump's bad behavior and offering no apology. That's one of the big arguments, Angie, that Democrats have made against Republicans, which is that they're playing kind of logical games to get around the evidence, complaining about the process because they have no counterargument to the facts.
There has not been much, if anything, presented to rebut the facts. The facts being the money was held up. Trump had this call with Zelensky. Certainly Trump's team, such as Ambassador Gordon Sondland, thought there was a connection between having an announcement of an investigation and getting aid, getting a White House visit. And nobody's really presented anything to say like, oh, no, that didn't happen. I mean, from all the witnesses and all the testimony, and a lack of counterfacts, that did happen.
Although, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Although there's the record of the call of that July 25th call between President Trump and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, in which he talked about this favor. And part of what's come out in these hearings, including yesterday's hearing before the House Judiciary Committee, or Monday's hearings before the House Judiciary Committee and the hearings before the Intelligence Committee, is what the president actually meant by what he said to Volodymyr Zelensky, whether he meant do me a favor or whether he actually meant we want Ukraine to investigate real, honest-to-goodness corruption.
Yeah, the problem with this line of argument, and I've thought about it a lot, is like that Trump and his team also had the ambassador removed, Maria Yovanovitch, who by all accounts was very strong on anti-corruption. So if you're going to make the argument that Trump was generally concerned about corruption, you have to square it with the removal of this anti-corruption ambassador. And that's challenging. So I think everybody, one of the nice things about this case is that there's a lot of primary documentation that people can read for themselves. So we can all read the transcript of this call and decide for ourselves what we think of the tenor of the conversation. Certainly, I think it's a hard case to make that Trump was generally concerned about corruption because of the other, the context and the other circumstances.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Elizabeth, what about the other piece of Mike's comment? He wrote, I'm equally amazed at how the Democrats burrow through the political quagmire without concern for House rules or the lack of physical evidence. I think Mike might have a point in that regard. I watched this week's House Judiciary Committee hearing. There were a number of times where Congressman Gerald Nadler, who's the chair of the committee, was dealing with parliamentary requests and points of order from some of the Republican members, and he just barreled right through them, which is against Robert's Rules of Order. You actually do have to take those up. So there were some moments in the hearing where I looked at it and I was like, ooh, this doesn't look right.
Well, I think, when everything else is against you on the facts, you argue process. And I think that's where a lot of the Republicans are. I think that, you know, the hearings Congressman Nadler certainly has a different style from Congressman Schiff, but he has been following the House resolution broadly covering the way that impeachment will continue.
You're talking about House Resolution 660 when they keep bringing that up. That's
exactly
the resolution that kind of governs this process.
Right. And, you know, I think people are watching a lot of congressional hearings for the first time. You know, it's frustrating to be in the minority when you're on a committee. But that's how the process works. And I don't think there have been process violations. I think it's a talking point that Republicans turn to because they don't really have any substantive ones. But the process is important here. And the processes that we're talking about big picture are the most important. I think, you know, pulling back from the facts, what we're talking about in these articles of impeachment are, can we trust that our democracy is going to work as it's supposed to? Can we trust that the checks and balances in the Constitution are going to work if they're supposed to? And if you have a president who is seeking foreign interference in the American election, and, you know, that could be a campaign finance violation. Getting dirt on your political opponent is certainly very valuable. And we have campaign rules against foreign governments contributing to American campaigns. So can you trust that it's a free and fair election without foreign interference? Can you trust that Congress is going to be able to fulfill its constitutional oversight role, the checks and balances role? And when you have a president who's obstructing justice, obstructing Congress's impeachment inquiry, you can't trust that. So that's really what we're talking about, these big picture American democratic processes questions.
Professor Blackmun, I'd love you to respond to John, who wrote on our Facebook page, another talking point from the Republicans is that this impeachment will lower the bar. If President Trump is impeached over this, then future presidents will be impeached over anything. But if we look back at the Clinton impeachment and the magnitude of the allegations in comparison from Clinton to Trump, the bar has definitely gone up. Professor, what do you think?
I think the comment is astute. The risk always is not about this president, but the presidency in general. Once you decouple impeachment from any sort of spelled out, clearly identified offense, people may think, oh, well, you're just making this up. This abuse of power thing is garbage, right? It's not a real thing. And once the crime turns almost entirely on what was the president's motivation, you have to basically get inside the president's head, and that's always a risky thing to do. I worry in the future we'll see impeachment where the minority party simply thinks that the president was not acting in the public interest as they see it. And there's a very short distance between what you might see as an obviously corrupt intent and one where we just think the president had the wrong set of policies. I worry that impeachment will become this quadrennial event where almost every 4 years you'll have this sort of effort to investigate the president, and if the president stymies the investigation, you can impeach him for not coming along with the investigation. If your readers are interested, I have a piece in The Atlantic on this issue today. We're heading to some risky, uncharted territories, and it may feel salutary to impeach and try to remove President Trump, but this will have consequences that endure beyond this administration.
It's so interesting, though, Professor, because even the founders were a little bit kind of vague in terms of what was impeachable. I mean, I think it was James Madison at the Constitutional Convention who said a president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution. Subverting the Constitution could mean a lot of things. So I hear you. It's like there's a line where we've got to be open to things we can't foresee. But if we make the field of those things too broad, then impeachment means nothing. It becomes a political cudgel.
Well, let me give you one instance. One of the framers, his name was George Mason from Virginia, and he proposed adding a standard in the Constitution called maladministration. You could be removed if you engage in maladministration. Mal means bad. Administration means, you know, exercising power. In other words, if you engage in power in a bad way, that seems very close to what abuse of power means. The framers rejected maladministration, and instead they used the phrase high crimes or misdemeanors. I think we have to be very careful when the assertion of what the offense is something that you think is basically a political offense, that person exercised judgment to perhaps benefit himself and not others, where there's no clear offense. And let me answer a question you posed to my friend a moment ago. Why was bribery not included?
Uh-huh.
Bribery is a fairly well-established offense. There's certain elements. Quid pro quo is just the start. What is the public act you're exchanging? What is the public act you're getting?
Right, right.
I think the Democrats worry that they couldn't meet the requirements for bribery. So what they do, they took the exact same conduct and they mishmashed it into this abuse of power standard where you don't have all these sort of technical requirements.
I want to talk more about how, sorry to cut you short, we're up against the break. I want to talk more about how this plays in the Senate when we come back. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Angie Holland, Associate Professor Josh Blackman, and Elizabeth Wydra. Still time to get in a few more of your questions and thoughts, 1A@WAMU.org. Jamie tweeted, "My biggest fear is that this impeachment isn't going to work, and all it's going to do is fire up Trump's base and put him back in office for 4 more years and make the Democrats look weak because they couldn't get it done." Elizabeth Wydra, I totally see Jamie's point, and I am beginning to think that if a Democrat does not win in 2020, that there are going to be some heads that are going to roll at the top of the Democratic leadership, because if they couldn't get Hillary Clinton elected with the majority of the popular vote, and if they couldn't beat Donald Trump after all of this, then I think a lot of Democrats are going to be saying, you know, maybe we need a full-scale rethinking of who's running this party.
So I certainly hear that a lot, the idea that if the Senate isn't going to convict on the articles of impeachment, what is the point? And I think it's because, gosh, if this deep undermining of the Office of Public Trust of the United States President, the interference with our free and fair democratic elections and the very processes that are written into our constitutional democracy are not worthy of impeachment, then what is? And as a constitutional lawyer, as someone who loves the Constitution and has, for weirdly reasons I can't explain since birth, this document is dear to me, and I am proud that there are people standing up for it in the House, even if the Senate puts party above country and doesn't go along with it. So, you know, I'm not a political consultant, and I don't think that, you know, contrary to some people who think the Democrats are doing this for political reasons, I'm not even sure this is a smart political move. That's not my portfolio. But from a constitutional perspective, it's absolutely essential, and not just for this president, but for all the ones to come.
Angie Holland, what's your sense of Jamie's comment? I think that on the flip side of what Jamie is saying, for some people, is the argument that the president's base, and this is not my perspective, this is what I've heard some other folks say, but that the president's base is so bought in that even in light of all the facts about what the president has done, has said, that it will just cause them to double down. They won't care. They'll remain willfully ignorant. They will take that as even more reason to rebel against the swamp and reelect Donald Trump.
I think we're at a moment of extreme uncertainty, Joshua. It's really, to me, as a fact checker, someone who deals with facts and evidence, it's kind of wild how partisan and how polarized people are, how some of the senators said that they weren't even going to look at some of the evidence. Now, I'm sure that will change when it gets to a trial. But the way that the political parties have separated into teams, and it really doesn't matter what the facts or the evidence are, you just stick with your team. And I think that's especially true with President Trump. It's hard to fathom. And what this is going to mean in the 2020 election, you just, nobody can know. It may come down to a handful of states in the Midwest that decide who the next president will be. I'm sure it will be a very close election. That seems baked in right now. When people are winning elections on these extremely narrow margins, everything matters. So I'm not sure even how much specific party leadership can sway something one way or the other. I mean, it's just a very odd moment.
Professor Blackman, what do you think about the deep partisanship in this process thus far? Rick tweeted, "While I can clearly hear the evidence and believe that Trump is guilty, I tune out when I see the partisan votes. Votes along party lines are laughable. No X number of people all agree. This in itself is a disgrace to the country on both sides." Professor Blackman, what about that?
The framers didn't really anticipate the rise of political parties. That was a creation that emerged at some point after the Constitution was ratified. But by the election of 1800, we had these sharply divided parties that basically hated each other and wanted to destroy each other. So there's nothing particularly new. But I think the founders did insert one provision to reflect that risk. To remove a president, you need a two-third majority vote, which means you need basically a supermajority to get rid of the president. That's a very high burden. And I think the requirement to have two-thirds suggests that you need more than a simple majority, that you need, and that now today is just more than one party. And I fear that having a straight party line vote to remove President Trump will simply translate to another straight party line vote to try to remove the next Democratic president. This will be something where we'll deal with every 4 years now. I don't think this is going to be a one-off, right? You don't try to remove a president and just go back to things like normal. I think every time this happens, it ratchets level one step up. I think this is our new the new world we live in.
I don't know if there are any musical theater nerds out there, but as soon as you mentioned the election of 1800, I immediately heard that song from Act Two of Hamilton in the back of my head. Am I the only one who had that? Elizabeth, can you?
Oh, yes. I'm not going to sing it.
Okay. I just want to make sure I'm not the only one who was hearing, like, every action has an equal opposite reaction. You make me feel much better. Quite a few of you expressed your thoughts about what happens in the Senate. And I totally hear you, Professor, in terms of why the founders wanted it to be a two-thirds majority. We got a ton of comments about the Senate. Here's a quick mashup of some of what you left in our inbox.
Hi, this is Matt calling from Louisville, Kentucky. It's really terrifying for me to see it going to Senate and being such a partisan issue in regards to the voting on it and him actually being impeached. With it being so partisan, if he doesn't get impeached, I see it as more of a fuel to the fire for his reelection.
This is Sue from Northern Virginia. And in regards to the impeachment inquiry, I do believe that the evidence shows President Trump has committed a pretty egregious abuse of power. But there is no way that they are going to reach a two-thirds majority in the Senate for conviction.
My name is Jeff. I think the whole thing is a complete waste of time. There's no path forward. If you don't have an end game in sight, why pursue it? And I can get noble causes, but this is a political process. And in a political process, your objective is to get something done or passed.
Thank y'all for sharing your thoughts with us. Now, I think that House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff kind of anticipated some of that concern yesterday when the articles of impeachment were unveiled. He responded to complaints about the House not wanting to move forward with impeachment, to this possibly being futile in the Senate. Here is part of what Chairman Schiff said.
Now, some would argue, why don't you just wait? Why don't you just wait until you get these witnesses the White House refuses to produce? Why don't you just wait until you get the documents the White House refuses to turn over? The argument, why don't you just wait, amounts to this. Why don't you just let him cheat in one more election?
That was House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff speaking yesterday. Professor Blackman, let me come back to you. What about that argument in terms of saying, well, if we wait, we're basically letting the president cheat again?
I think the argument is, if the House feels that they have grounds for impeachment, I think they actually have a duty to proceed. The fact that we have an election coming up in, a little bit less than a year, doesn't eliminate the House's duty to impeach. But you have to recognize how this will be perceived in the public. We're going to have an impeachment vote probably about 2 weeks after the articles are released, and then we'll have a vote in the full House right before Christmas. We may be having a impeachment trial as the Iowa caucus goes on. Depending how long the trial goes, I can see this trial going maybe a couple months. I mean, it depends if the Republicans want this to be long or short. Keep in mind, during the Senate trial, all the senators, including Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, have to sit there all day in absolute silence. Yes, you heard me right. They cannot say a word. They basically sit as a court, as a jury. So basically incapacitates to the leading candidates. There might be reasons why they keep them in town. So this can be basically going up until the political conventions later this summer. So while the constitutional duty exists, the political optics suggest that this is almost like a this last minute effort right before people go to vote.
Ray tweeted, "The Republicans' notion that the Democrats should let the people decide in the next election is ridiculous. The Constitution says nothing about a referendum for impeachment. This is the job of Congress. The House Democrats are just doing their job, and for Republicans, it's a political football." Julia tweeted, "When the Senate votes against impeachment," note Julia said when the Senate votes against impeachment, "I believe the House should continue with obtaining the tax returns and other witness testimony and begin impeachment hearings again for campaign finance violations and emoluments violations." Angie, by the way, do we have any numbers on where Americans fall when it comes to support for impeachment and or removal? What do the polls tell us?
Well, the polls have been show a polarized electorate. I know, a big shock. Some of the recent polls have shown just over 50% in favor of impeachment of or removal. Now, when events play out, sometimes those numbers drop down below 50% to like 49%, 48%. So the polls have been hovering around those numbers. Now, going back to the Senate, just to bring politics back into it, about a third of the Senate is up for re-election in 2016. So I think these senators are going to be having that on their mind as they vote either for or against impeachment. And some of these senators are Republicans who sit in swing states. And I'm very interested to watch how they speak about impeachment, what they say, how they end up voting, because I do think the Democrats are going to want to make an argument in the fall that Republicans are too beholden to Donald Trump. And so that is one of the undercurrents of the Senate trial.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Elizabeth, I'd like you to respond to another mashup of some voters or some listeners who feel turned off by the actions of House Democrats, by the impeachment process. Here's a mashup of what they left in our inbox.
My name is Dan. I'm an unaffiliated voter from Florida. I have previously voted for the best candidate. I've always voted for the person I thought that would do the job. That included Bush, Clinton. I even voted for Obama. But what the Democrats' actions have shown me is that they don't really hate Trump. They hate me as a voter for voting for Trump.
This is Tom from Atlanta. I have been following these proceedings carefully. I believe that the proceedings, and especially the articles of impeachment, are a gross miscarriage of the power and confidence that we have given our representatives in government. It has encouraged me to vote party line Republican in the next election in order to keep this from happening again in our House of Representatives.
Hello, this is Steve from Chicago. I've been watching and reviewing these impeachment proceedings from the beginning, and from everything I can see, it is a sham power grab by the Democrats, which, as a lifelong Democrat, has really made me sad of what's happening to the country.
Dan, Tom, Steve, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. So, Elizabeth, it sounds like these three voters, at least, are kind of doubling down on supporting the GOP as a result of their perception of what the Democrats are doing.
Yeah, I think that perception goes to just emphasize that I don't think that the Democrats in the House are doing this because they think there's some great political gain to be had. I think they're doing it because they believe it's their constitutional duty. And I would hope that voters would see that, you know, you can respect that. That at least is done in good faith rather than some of these bad faith arguments we're seeing from Republicans like Lindsey Graham in the Senate saying he's not even going to look at the evidence. That's not their constitutional duty.
Although the Democrats clearly want Donald Trump gone. There's no doubt about that.
Right. But I think that, you know, arguably from some of these political polls and from these responses that we just heard, impeachment might not be, you know, the easiest way for Democrats to get rid of him. It might be just focusing on the election. But I think that they really feel constitutionally obligated. Nancy Pelosi, as we saw, was not eager to get into impeachment. She really had to be brought there by the president's actions himself.
I think dragged is a fair word.
Dragged, I think, is a fair word. And I think, frankly, the articles of impeachment also show that they are taking this process seriously, because I think they are putting forth articles that if you had a Senate acting in good faith and not just following party lines, I think there would be a real question of whether you could get two-thirds of the Senate to convict on those narrow articles. If you wanted to appeal to the Democratic base, you'd probably put something in there about how the president is caging children at the border and letting young children die of the flu on cold, hard floors. You know, there are ways, if you wanted to make this purely political, you would do this differently.
Before we wrap up, Professor, what is the one thing you think the founders would want us to keep in mind as we view this impeachment process? If any of them was here right now, what's the one thing they would most want us to remember?
To act prudently and keep in mind whatever precedent we have here, how that could translate to future impeachments. James Madison worried that if we have too broad of a standard for removal, then the president serves at the Senate's pleasure. And I think that's something to keep in mind, that we should exercise this power responsibly and as concretely as possible.
And Angie, as someone who fact checks for a living, there's a real concern that some people are going to make their decisions based on their gut rather than the evidence. Certainly, some on the political left say that the evidence is overwhelming. To those who are making this emotion more with their heart than their head, regardless of the facts, what do you want them to keep in mind?
I want them to keep in mind that there is a lot of documentation on this. They can do their own reading and their own research and look carefully at some of the reports that have been written, the transcripts. I know I'm asking people to do homework, but it does feel like right now, as citizens, we all need to do some homework because these are not easy issues. You can't digest them in just a few minutes watching TV. If you really want to understand what's going on, invest some time.
Angie Holin, editor for PolitiFact, a good place to do some of that homework, PolitiFact. Angie, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Josh Blackman, associate professor of law at the South Texas College of Law. Thank you, professor.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Wydra, president of the progressive think tank, the Constitutional Accountability Center. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame. You can learn about our team at the1a.org/staff. And hey, if you want to start on that homework, you can go to npr.org/impeachment. A lot of the documents in the background you need is all right there. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.